From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, stand-up comic Eddie Izzard. A huge star in England, Izzard is currently performing off-Broadway in his new one-man show, Dressed to Kill. Although he calls himself a transvestite or a male lesbian, he says his look is really not part of the act. Also, keeping up appearances while dealing with cancer. We talk with editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar, Liz Talbaras. She'll tell us how she led editorial meetings from her hospital bed during bone marrow transplant treatments. She has a new memoir. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Teletubbies, the hit British TV series geared towards 1 to 3-year-olds, which premieres on PBS this week. All that and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell will be at the White House this afternoon, briefing President Clinton on the peace deal he brokered for Northern Ireland. Mitchell chaired the 8-party talks for 21 months, leading to last Friday's historic agreement. Mitchell wants the president to travel to Northern Ireland before next month's referendum on the deal. The White House says no decision's been made. Nations Bank and Bank America say they're merging to create the nation's largest bank. This while Bank One has announced it's merging with First Chicago. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco.
The first deal is between Nations Bank and Bank of America. It's valued at $60 billion, $20 billion less than the record-breaking Citicorp merger last week. The new bank will have 5,000 branches coast to coast and $570 billion in assets. The second deal is somewhat smaller. It's a stock swap valued at about $30 billion between Bank One and First Chicago. Recently, banks have been merging with each other at a furious pace in hopes of cutting costs to increase profits. Several other big deals are said to be in the pipeline. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin is reaffirming his nominee for prime minister, despite opposition from members of parliament. From Moscow, Phil Itner reports.
By issuing thinly veiled threats to dismiss parliament, Boris Yeltsin today kept the pressure on opposition leaders in a bid to install Sergei Kiryenko as prime minister. Friday will be the second time the lower house of parliament, or Duma, votes on Kiryenko. Under Russian law, if there is no prime minister chosen after 3 votes, the Duma must be disbanded and early elections held. Russia has been without a formalized government for 3 weeks now. Last week, ministers voted down Kiryenko, complaining he is too inexperienced to lead the troubled nation. Yeltsin immediately renominated the 35-year-old. Now some ministers are demanding Yeltsin put forward another name, warning they would again vote against Kiryenko. But Yeltsin says he has no other candidate. Many experts say the Russian president should be able to eventually force Kiryenko into power because ministers fear an early election more than they fear having Kiryenko as prime minister. For NPR News, I'm Phil Itner in Moscow.
Talks between North and South Korea have broken up for the day, with the two sides unable to narrow differences on some key issues. South Korea's chief delegate says Seoul is holding firm on its position regarding 200,000 tons of fertilizer aid to the North. South Korea wants the aid tied to several items, including reuniting families separated for the past 50-plus years. The talks will resume tomorrow in Beijing. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 39 points at 8955.51. The Nasdaq is down nearly 10 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, it's been a big start to the week for Wall Street in terms of deals, but so far, the stock market doesn't seem to be going along for the ride. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
By and large, it's been a good day to own bank stocks. Merger deals involving Nations Bank and Bank America and Bank One and First Chicago are having a big impact on the financial markets today. Chase Manhattan shares have been higher today amid a report in Barron's that a merger between the New York-based bank and Merrill Lynch might make sense. Other bank stocks like Wells Fargo and Mellon have also risen sharply as investors bet they could be the next good-sized banks to be gobbled up in a merger deal. The overall market, however, remains mixed. The Dow moved lower shortly after the opening bell in New York. That was on speculation that many of the companies due to weigh in with their first quarter earnings this week will disappoint Wall Street. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Compaq says it's cut prices on selected models of its Desk Pro personal computers. The company says prices were reduced by as much as 25% on some models. Compaq stock was down 25 cents at mid-morning on the New York Stock Exchange. The world's largest maker of elevators is cutting 2,000 jobs as part of a major restructuring. Otis Elevator says it's closing 13 of its 19 engineering centers. Otis says it also plans to reduce the number of its overseas factories. The company says it's already eliminated half of the jobs, 90 of them coming from its lone U.S. factory in Indiana. Authorities say 17 people were hurt today when an Amtrak train slammed into several cars of a derailed freight train. That collision occurred west of Pittsburgh. None of the injuries were serious. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. A lot of stand-up comedians come on stage in conventional clothes, jeans, or maybe a suit. It's their material which is shocking and scandalous. Then there's British comedian Eddie Izzard, who dresses in drag and talks about toast.
Toasted! Ah, toasters are good. Like them. Like toast. It's got toaster there, but it's got a turny dial knob thing on the side. And it lies to us. It does not tell the truth, for it has numbers from 1 to 6, and they lie. You set on 4, you put bread in on 4, and boom, comes up 3. This is 3 toast, no good at all. Hardly done. You set and change to 5, you put, comes up 6. This is 6, all burnt. Scrape. Oh, it, forget it. Because the toast is in there going, stay down, lad, stay down. Stay down, go for the burn. No pain, no gain. No fish, no fowl. No socks, no shoes. No hair, no haircut. And the other toast going, what the hell are you talking about?
Eddie Izzard's new one-man show, Dressed to Kill, is running off-Broadway at the Westbeth Theatre. He's a cult figure in England, where Channel 4 television once celebrated his birthday by proclaiming it Eddie Izzard Day, scheduling all his favorite movies and TV series, including The $6 Million Man. John Cleese of Monty Python, one of Izzard's idols, calls him the funniest man in England, maybe on the planet. His one-man show, Dressed to Kill, is basically full-speed-ahead stand-up comedy, a mixture of skits about anything and everything from British imperialism and the Anglican Church to the American space program and Star Trek. You have a sketch in Dressed to Kill about Engelbert Humperdinck. And after a bit, you say very seriously, it was sad, though, that you just heard on the news that Humperdinck died in L.A. yesterday. And you get everyone going, everyone believes this, and then you say, no, he didn't, you're all so gullible. And you go back and forth. You have people, yes, he did, no, he didn't. You have tremendous control over the audience. How did you learn to command that kind of control over an audience?
That's through street performing. Yeah, that's you learn to manipulate the energy of a crowd, which sounds kind of floaty and sort of
new agey.
But yeah, but it is true. An audience has an energy, and it can be all over the place, or it can be quite. And if you're a good performer, you can knit it together as a tight thing so that they react as one. And the street performing is so experimental because you constantly have cats and dogs and cars driving through your show and drunk people walking through your show and police telling you to move on. And it's just and the weather stuff rains on your head or snows or there's wind. So there's a lot of natural ad-libbing happening or natural forces happening against your show. So you just learn to be able to deal with anything. After street performing, you can deal with anything.
How do you handle heckling? Do you try to take it as a challenge to work the heckling into your act?
No, heckling is just another... I've analyzed heckling enough to know that it's not really a problem. I've done far too much performing for them to be able to do anything to me. And it's you basically the best position to adopt if you're being heckled as a performer is a hugely arrogant one. And which is quite fun, being able to play arrogance or just be incredibly arrogant, because it's not normally a very socially acceptable position to adopt. But if someone starts challenging your show, then you can just tear them apart, because they will never have had as much experience as you've had on stage. So they challenge you, and they think it's you against them. But in fact, the whole audience, if they're with you at this point, is your gang. So they're on your side. They want you to win. And in fact, most hecklers, 90% of hecklers, are actually just trying to help you or trying to feed the show. Unless you're actually on stage and dying thunderously and having a really bad time, and then the hecklers come in and attack.
You say right at the start of your new show that you're a male transvestite and you fancy women. You're a tomboy. You're a male lesbian.
Who said that? God, that's all. Yes, that's absolutely true. What did I say? Male tomboy. Yeah. Male tomboy or male lesbian. Male lesbian explains and confuses at the same time, which I like because it's kind of like washing powder. It washes and it cleans. It dries as it hangs, as it flips over. Yeah, because most male transvestites do fancy women, I believe. I strongly believe now. Because there's distinct link-ups, a lot of sexuality traits which go together. And in the alternative sexuality area, so if you're gay, lesbian, or TV, a lot of people hate using the word transvestite because there's very negative connotations on it. But I'm actually reclaiming on that word. But TV is the shortened version of it, or cross-dresser. But in fact, there are no cross-dressers because, I mean, transvestite just is Latin for cross-dresser. So why we should go around using a Latin term, I do not know. But, you know, there are no women transvestites, are there? Since the 20s, women have successfully removed the term transvestite from our social dictionary. Don't you think?
Absolutely. Well, it has no meaning.
It has been totally moved. Whereas back in the 20s, it would have been used. If we went back in a time machine or looked in history books, it would be used as reference. And they had women doing male impersonations on stage in vaudeville. They definitely did in London. And now it's gone. So that's great. Women have total clothing rights. And I think men have total clothing rights if they want them. They're just sitting there to grab. So I grab them and I wear whatever I want. And it has nothing to do with my comedy.
How do you choose what to wear?
Well, I go into a choice section part of my brain, and it has little gates that go yes or no, and I go through all my clothing and I go yes, no. Oh, how do you choose where you wear clothes? I just choose by the normal thought processes. There's no big deal. And how do you choose where you wear clothes? You just how you feel, yeah?
Right.
And it's that kind of thing.
Well, thank God no one looks at me when I do my work. I mean, that's
oh yeah, when you go on stage, well then it sort of does this go with that and this and I end up in this sort of tomboy area-y kind of, I don't know, I keep trying to move it around. Clothes are just clothes. They're just bits of cloth. Just wear them. It doesn't matter.
When you first came out, some people, when they first come out, they have a female persona. They give themselves another name when they dress as a woman or whatever, put these clothes on. Did you do that?
Well, sort of, but there was an idea, because I said male lesbian, because I'd be quite happy to be a woman, but I look very male-like, because when you hit your teenage period, I know there's coding going in, so and everyone's, you know, up to puberty, girls and boys have a pretty similar facial shape, but then I've got into this sort of male jawline area, so it's I just look like a guy who wears makeup. So yeah, initially when I came out, I was sort of trying to pass as a woman type thing, but everyone said, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, getting in and out of taxis or whatever. So I thought, oh, well, stuff this. This isn't going to work. I'm very practical. In my approach to being getting this thing working for me. So I've come to a much more sort of tomboy area. And it's also, it's much easier for me because I'm in the entertainment world. You know, if you're a lawyer, if you're a forklift truck driver, there's a lot of, because if you are transvestite, there's a lot of male in you. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of people in the army, a lot of people do very male jobs and are TV. And it's a tricky area because, you know, you're surrounded by a lot of people who are deep into macho and the machismo. And so you trying to express your feminine side is very difficult in that middle area. Or trying to get to a middle area. But in the entertainment world, it's our duty in the end to find the way out, because, you know, like Marlene Dietrich and Katharine Hepburn were the first women to really wear pants and so get that whole thing going, and they were big movie stars, so everyone said, oh, if they can do it, then we can do it, and then it became a fashion thing, and that's the way it's got to start. So, you know, by the when we get in the 21st century, it's going to chill out and everyone can wear whatever clothes they want. It'll take some time, but, you know, it's much more positive these days.
I don't want to beat this to death, but I do have one more question. I'm just curious. when you decide to come out, I imagine you have to experiment a little bit first. Do you start very, very
frumpy.
Discreetly or frumpy?
No, frumpy. You have to go through frumpy, transvestite. Well, it's somewhere between frumpy and over the top. You have to go through your teenage girl phase. You know when teenage girls first get access to clothing? Because there is a phase where I remember watching a sort of magazine daytime chat show type thing in London, in the United Kingdom, and there was a mother going on about her daughter. She was 11. She was wearing these high heels. She'd caught her own daughter wearing high heels and makeup, and I told her to get this stuff off, she was saying. And I thought, hey, this could have just been me, this teenage girl. That's what I would have gone through, because it's just fun clothing. That's why I think women who do want to wear heels and makeup and whatever, it's just kind of fun. And then when you go through the teenage girl phase, where you go to your first disco and teenage girls just wear far too much and there's too much makeup and skirts too short and way over the top. And then in the 20s, when women get in their 20s, I feel they chill out and think, oh, I'm not going to wear this all the time. This is a real pain. And just, it's so laborious putting, you know, makeup is quite a... just fiddly to do, and so you'd just rather not wear makeup. So women in their 20s and their 30s, they just chill out and say, well, if I want to dress up, I can, but if I want to dress down, I can as well. And that's the phase I've got to now. So I started out and the heels were too high and the look was all wrong. And you have to also get a look. You have to be able to wear clothes so that you can have friends saying, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, that looks good on you. That doesn't work. And, you know, and I've got a kind of blokey male body, so I've got to say what goes with this and what doesn't go with this. Okay, my legs are better, all right, that's good, but you know, it's just trying to get, my body shape slightly different, so, but then a lot of women have, there's women who go through, and men who go through lots of different facial looks and body shapes. There's women who are very mannish looking, there's men that are very feminine looking, and there's the whole gamut of range of looks are there. So, you can always get a look that will work with you.
My guest is British comedian Eddie Izzard. His new one-man show is Dress to Kill. He's appearing at the Westbeth Theatre off Broadway in New York City. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with British comedian Eddie Izzard. His new one-man show is Dress to Kill. It's appearing at the Westbeth Theatre off Broadway. Your mother died when you were six. Did you develop ways of coping as kids do, have imaginary playmates or imagine conversations with her?
No, I started performing, I think, because of that. I mean, people do think, oh, your mother died. Oh, that means that's the transvestite link-up thing. But I don't think so, because I just knew I was TV before she died. But I don't know. I'm still open-minded about that. I think the key thing that happened was that the performing happened, because I wasn't really... I remember doing a sort of school play. I was six. I was a raven. My mother made me a raven suit. I'm glad I wasn't very good at as a raven. And that's good, because, you know, there's not a lot of raven parts around. And I wasn't that bothered about doing the show. But then after she died, I remember seeing a play and thinking, I've got to do this. And there was sort of applause going on. And I think it's a surrogate affection machine, because my mum was there and she was very affectionate. Then she disappears and then the audience is there. And I have to perform, you know. It's quite good, because you don't just stand there and they give you affection. You've got to go out and do your best. And if you're interesting, they go, hey, that's good. And then it sort of takes off.
Yeah, it's really the opposite of unconditional love.
Yes, it's conditional. It's very conditional, depending on the reviews.
You've acted on stage in London in Mamet plays and other plays. You have a movie coming out with Sean Connery, a takeoff on the Avengers, the old Avengers series. What's your role like?
I have the biggest role in the Avengers. It's really my film, and Sean agreed
cameos.
To be in it. I have a small role. I'm Sean Connery's the bad guy, and I'm second bad guy, and I go around hitting people on the head, and I stare at them, and I hit them, and I chew gum, and I have a huge fight with Uma Thurman, who's Emma Peel, and wears a lot of very tight, rubbery type clothing, which looks very good on her, and my role is more supporting and helping them get their lines right and giving them cups of tea and stuff. But it's the Avengers, which not everyone knows them in America, but it was a great British cult, kind of quirky, campy type thing. Camp in a good way, not camp in a... Camp in a sort of sassy, surreal and dry humour type way.
You have a really a physical presence, and your face is very expressive. Did you have to tone anything down to act on screen? I'm thinking that exaggerates, of course, every facial expression, especially in close-up.
Well, I don't do comedy roles on television, so it's a totally different beast, really. I approach it a totally different way, and I don't pull big old faces. Hey, look, I can do wide mouth frog impressions.
You don't want to be cast as a funny role?
Yeah, I don't do comedy roles, and I'm not doing transvestite roles, because everyone's come and say, hey, comedy transvestite, here, there's a comedy transvestite role. And I'm just going, no, I'm just going to play straight roles, straight dramatically and just ordinary orthodox sexuality area. Later on, I can play a transvestite role when I've found the right one or whatever. And comedy, I don't want to play comedy, because my comedy is... I was very influenced by Steve Martin, and I just listened to his CD again, early CDs of stand-up, and if you hit in this area of kind of crazy, surreal stuff, people just want to see you do that. They don't want to see you do anything, any straight role, because the hits of comedy are just so buzzy that you don't want... You can't wait around to get the slow feel, the slow burn of someone who's bringing a character to a screen over, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. You get drawn into believing in this person as being a real person.
Eddie Izzard, I want to thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thanks very much.
Eddie Izzard's one-man show, Dressed to Kill, is running at the Westbeth Theater in New York. Last week, the British TV series Teletubbies came to America via PBS. The show is aimed at young viewers, 1 to 3 years old. Lots of critics are complaining that the show should be reviled for targeting an audience that young and for programming a children's show that's full of repetition, baby talk, and surrealistic images. But our TV critic, David Biancooley, isn't complaining at all.
Time for Teletubbies! Time for Teletubbies! Time for Teletubbies! Time for Teletubbies!
Dinky Winky!
Hinky Winky!
Dipsy! La La!
La La!
Ho!
Ho!
Teletubbies!
Teletubbies!
Say hello!
The way I figure it, your reaction to Teletubbies is directly linked to your reaction to another PBS preschool series, Barney and Friends. If you dislike Barney, you'll probably like Teletubbies. And since Barney, to me, is the purple Antichrist, I love Teletubbies. Everything that Barney does wrong, Teletubbies does right. Barney takes existing folk songs and nursery rhymes and butchers them by substituting its own idiotic lyrics. Teletubbies presents original music, very charming music, and classic unaltered nursery rhymes. Where Barney lives in our world, the four Teletubbies, who look like the results of munchkins mated with Muppets, live in their own. It's a rolling pasture with real rabbits and wildflowers all around, and with a built-in grass-covered dome home where the Teletubbies sleep, eat, and exercise. In England, where the BBC introduced Teletubbies 14 months ago, it's become the most popular children's program in British TV history. It's also a cult hit among college students, who have embraced Teletubbies with giddy affection as a sort of drug-free 60s-era acid flashback. For America, most of the British voices and film shorts of little kids at play have been replaced with homegrown counterparts, but the dubbing isn't that extensive. The four plush roly-poly Teletubbies Tinky Winky, Dipsy, Lala, and Po don't say much. And their vocabulary is strictly baby talk. Their favorite phrases are gen and big hugs. Each episode of Teletubbies has the same structure, allowing for both familiarity and expectation from a very early age. Each Teletubbies begins and ends with, respectively, a sunrise and sunset, except that within the sun is the face of a happy, squealing baby, delighting in all the action down below. Meanwhile, the Teletubbies jump up and down or dance to music and nursery rhymes, which are broadcast from speakers that rise out of the ground like submarine periscopes.
Whoa! Again! Again, again!
Ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross to see a fine lady upon a white horse. With rings on her fingers and bells on her toes, she shall have music wherever she goes.
Yay! Again, again! No!
Ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross.
Many critics, acting like crabby Teletubbies, are jumping up and down too, complaining about what they see as the show's strong Orwellian subtext. They hate the repetition, and they're spooked by the idea that each Teletubby has an antenna atop his or her head and receives video signals that are displayed on the Teletubbies' Teletummies. These incoming signals are short films about very little kids doing things like riding ponies and taking stroller rides. But let's get real here and allow kids to get a little less real. Any adult viewers who don't see the magic of Teletubbies are like the adults in the Polar Express who can no longer hear the tinkle of the bell from Santa's sleigh because they've lost their ability to believe. The Teletubbies' simple physical actions, rolling, jumping, hugging, walking, are things even toddlers can emulate. When a Teletubby screams "Gen," and an action or song is repeated, it's to please the youngest viewers, for whom repetition is a joy, not an ordeal. To parents who don't want their toddlers and young preschoolers to watch TV, don't let them watch. It's your choice, and the choice is that simple. But when one of the more popular TV shows in the 2 to 10 age bracket is the Jerry Springer Show, no one should give this new PBS series a hard time. For me, Teletubbies gets big hugs.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Liz Telberis, editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar, about dealing with ovarian cancer while working in the fashion industry. She has a new memoir. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about a reissue of American soprano Helen Boatwright performing the songs of Charles Ives, which he's been waiting for a long time. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogaev, sitting in for Terry Gross. By anyone's standards, as editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar and the mother of two young adopted sons, Liz Tilbaris leads a full life. And that's not even considering the fact that she has cancer. Tilbaris started her career in fashion in the psychedelic 60s at British Vogue. During 22 years at that magazine, she rose to editor and then landed the assignment of editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar. In 1991, she moved her family to New York and completely reorganized Bazaar, which won two national magazine awards in her first year at the helm. Then Tilbaris was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer. She believes her cancer was caused by extensive fertility treatments, which she underwent in her early 30s. Her new memoir, No Time to Die, describes her life in fashion and her experience dealing with her disease. I asked Liz Tilbaris when she first started feeling ill.
I had missed my yearly appointment, which was in the May of 93, and I was having quite a lot of symptoms. I was very depressed, which I never normally am. I felt very heavy, and I'd been feeling that way since the August. And it was now November, and I remember looking out of the house, out of the window on Thanksgiving Day, and thinking to myself, I'm really sick. I've got something wrong with me. I wonder if it's cancer. And the minute I got back to the city, I rang my gynecologist and said, I have to come in for an appointment. And it was then that she diagnosed it, and that was when everything started to happen so fast, because that was sort of the 1st or 2nd of December, and I was operated on by the 17th of December.
What made you think you had cancer?
I don't know. It was just a thought that passed by, and I think that was the first time that I really knew that I had to listen to my own body, because it was something that came just into my head as I looked out of the window. It was nothing. You know, it was a very quiet moment. I was all alone. Everybody was out of the house, and it just suddenly came to me. It had nothing to do with anything. Nothing at all.
It all seemed to happen very fast for you. You went in for surgery within days. The surgeon immediately operated and removed as much cancer as was possible, and then your chemo started. Now, anyone undergoing chemotherapy worries about their hair and their appearance, I imagine, but your business is all about appearance. How much did you worry about how chemo would affect what you looked like and how your colleagues and your competitors in the fashion world would judge you? How you looked?
Well, it was very interesting because one of my very best friends is a wonderful, wonderful hairdresser, and he had already been cutting my hair for years. And when we talked about the fact that I had cancer and was about to have chemotherapy, which was really at Christmas time. I mean, I was operated just before Christmas. And he said, I think, because I had, a shoulder-length bob of kind of wonderfully white hair, and he, you know, to me, it was my trademark, it was my symbol. And he said, I think, you know, if you're going to lose it, I think you should cut it off, because you don't really want, you know, a whole kind of heap of hair on the pillow when you wake up, because it does fall out. The minute you have adenomyosis, it falls out within 10 days of that. And so I agreed to let him cut it. And just before I cut it, we got hold via Sidney Lumet, the film director, a wonderful man who could make wigs. Because as you can imagine, I was really, I mean, vanity had taken over a little bit. I was quite worried as to how I would present myself in the marketplace, so to speak, with no hair. And he came on board. His name is Paul Huntley, and he's making wigs for everybody. And so he made this beautiful wig. So when my hair actually did fall out, I had what became known as Larry already sitting on my dressing table. And so I could feel the confidence of knowing that I could put this wig on when I was going to go out and back to work again. I think the other thing, I was discussing this with a friend of mine who just had breast cancer and lost all her hair. And I think that what happens, of course, is that you're so happy to be alive that in the end, although you've made all these preparations for your wig and for everything else that, you know, to make yourself look normal again, you're so happy to still be around your family and friends that it doesn't really, when it actually happens, it's not nearly as important as you think it's going to be prior to it happening.
Did you approach it, though, as a fashion editor? Here I go, I'm making my cancer makeover.
I didn't think of it like that, but I actually addressed it that way, yes. I mean, I didn't consciously think this was it, but I realized I had two very, very important events that I had to deal with. In fact, three, where I knew I would be, I had to, and one was I had to make a speech at the Waldorf, you know, to 4,000 people. Another one I had to give an award, rather, at the Council of Fashion Designers of America. And that was very daunting. And another one was we gave a dinner for Richard Avedon at the Whitney. And I knew I had to look like a real human being by that time. So, you know, that was when the resources that I do have, although not to do with my hair, I asked Ralph Lauren to make a dress for me, and I asked Calvin to make something for me for one of them. And, you know, that's when the fashion industry is incredible and really wonderful, and everybody pooled their resources, and I got clothes that actually fitted me, because I had lost at this point 30 pounds overnight, so to speak, when I'd had the operation. So I was much skinnier and nothing fitted. I mean, I had dresses to wear, but I couldn't, because I was a shell of my former self.
At one point, and this I didn't know about chemotherapy, you lose your facial hair also, your eyebrows,
your eyebrows and your eyelashes, and you develop this rather unattractive red rim around your eyes as well. The only thing you don't lose is your moustache, which is really depressing. So you keep the nastiest facial hair and lose the good bits, which is very sad. And nobody has to this day, although I've complained, pointed out as to why that doesn't happen. But anyway, so yes, I lost my eyebrows and I lost my eyelashes. And you don't really lose things like hair on your arms, for instance, although you lose underarm hair to a certain extent, and you don't have to ever shave your legs. I mean, that's extraordinary. But your arms that somehow don't get affected. It's very odd where the affectations take place. There's definitely a long book in that, I think.
You had a relapse in 1995 of cancer, and you underwent bone marrow transplant, which is, by all accounts, including your own, just an inhumanly grueling ordeal. But you directed staff meetings for Harper's Bazaar from your hospital bed in the isolation ward, and the staff had to wear masks and gowns.
Oh, it was terrible. But it was just a way of keeping going, I think. And I did make a lot of really bad decisions while I was lying in bed, high as a kite on morphine, because that was the only kind of drug that can take the pain away, because it's very, very painful.
Wasn't part of you during these meetings saying to yourself, oh, is this really the time to talk about hemlines?
But the funny thing is that that's all that really matters, because what's being done to you is being done. And so you want desperately to survive. And you want, I mean, I tried so hard to read books, but I couldn't concentrate. I tried so hard to watch television and I couldn't concentrate. And work was really the only thing where I could really fully grasp what was going on. And it was extraordinary. And everybody was very tolerant. I mean, my staff were magnificent, because I was not pretty. Because you can't swallow, you're dribbling all the time. And you have a little Hoover that sucks the saliva out of your mouth, and it's not a pretty color. It's not like regular saliva either. So these people were coming up and hearing me talk about cover lines and, you know, colors of the logo on the front of the magazine, and there I was hoovering away the saliva. It was just ghastly. I mean, they were very lovely, and I thank them all to this day for doing that.
How is your health now?
It's good. It's good. I mean, I still have a CA125 that blips. A normal person will have a CA125 of up to 35 points. When I was diagnosed in 1993, mine was well over 2,000, which means that there was a heavy dose of cancer circulating in my body. But with all the chemos that I've gone through, and only one lot of chemos really ever worked for me, so I've had a lot of chemo that I was resistant to, it's good. Meanwhile, they're trying to find chemos that when I really need to go back into having chemotherapy, which I probably will have to prophylactically, they're trying to find one that will actually work very well for me. And so that's our battle now, is to find one that I'm very sensitive to, that means that I will be able to reduce my CA125 to where it should be. It's not very elevated, but it does go up and down from time to time because they monitor it very closely.
My guest is Liz Tilberis. She worked her way up to editor-in-chief of British Vogue over 22 years at that magazine. In 1992, she took over as editor of Harper's Bazaar in New York. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer not long after that. She's written a memoir of her life in fashion magazines and her experiences dealing with cancer. It's called No Time to Die. We're going to take a break now, Liz, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. back with Harper's Bazaar editor Liz Tilberis. Her new memoir is No Time to Die. You write that British Vogue was the quasi-official documenter of the British royal family, and you, of course, featured Diana, Princess of Wales, many times in the magazine. How did you help to shape her image?
I didn't have anything to do with shaping her image in the early days. She first appeared on the Vogue scene about 1980 when she was engaged to be married. She was married in 1981. I started really working with her much later on, in about 1987, when I became the editor of British Vogue and realized that we had not taken any pictures of her for a while. And then the first time I really wanted to work with her, I persuaded her to wear jeans and a white shirt and be photographed with the boys at Highgrove. And although I didn't do the sitting, it was a sitting that I know she loved very, very much and treasured, you know, until she died. And it was really beautiful. And that was the very first time she sort of had been able to be casual in photographs. And we worked on from there with Patrick Marchelier taking the pictures. We just got a kind of wonderful rapport going, and every so 6 months or 9 months we'd have more pictures taken, and it was wonderful fun.
Did the royal family try in any way to pressure or censor your ideas about her informal image?
Not about the informal image, but when we tried to get her on the cover a couple of times, they felt it was inappropriate. There was one very beautiful cover when she was wearing a white chiffon Gina Frattini evening dress that actually appears on the back of the book that was written about her. And it was a really lovely cover, but the Buckingham Palace felt it was inappropriate because she was sitting on the floor. And then, of course, the very famous one, which has the tiara, and she is sitting on the floor with the taffeta embroidered dress, hugging her legs, was the one that we were not allowed to use on the cover. But the minute we were able to release it, or had to release it because that was the way we dealt with Buckingham Palace, we released it about 2 months later, and it was on every cover in every magazine right across the world. And we were the only magazine that didn't have it on the cover, which was very sad.
You were hired away from British Vogue to Harper's Bazaar in New York. How does the American fashion scene differ from the British one? Is it a whole other world or aesthetic, or is the fashion world so international that you didn't really have to adapt to much?
The first point is, yes, you're absolutely right. The fashion world is very, very international, and I didn't have to adapt that much, I thought. But America has this incredible home market. The retailing system in America is so senior compared to Europe. And it was that's always attracted me to America, because nowhere in the rest of the world can you go over 2,000 miles and find a similar store, whether it's Bloomingdale's, Neiman's, Saks, whoever. And it is incredibly good at supporting designers, in giving women in America what they want to wear. And I think that was one of the great, great benefits about coming here, is that fashion is taken very, very seriously. It's a very big industry. It's very, very important to the economics of the country. And in England, it's not. Although it's in the high street, it's not really at the senior level it is over here. Although you have stores like Debenhams and Marks and Spencers and things like that, they deal in budget clothes. And here in America, yes, we have great, great companies like The Gap and J. Crew and so on, that do have wonderful, wonderful clothes at a budget price. You also have these very, very senior retailing stores. And I find America an incredible place. If you're going to have a fashion magazine, this is the country to have it in.
One of the things you write that you most enjoy about your work is covering the big fashion shows, the Paris Couture. From what little I know of these events from the media, it looks like a circus. It looks like people are fighting to get in. Is the whole scene as brutal as it looks on the evening news?
Yes. In fact, once a long time ago, a security guard pushed a colleague of mine, and we were going up, you know, those entrances to cattle trucks? Well, this was entrance to a tent, but it was a cattle truck entrance. In other words, it had kind of grids going across it. And we were in our, you know, dressed in our nice clothes, because obviously we're supposed to be representing our magazines. And he pushed her, and I thought she was going to fall into a foot of mud kind of puddle that was underneath the tent. And I was really angry, so I punched him in the face. And unfortunately for the guard, nobody saw me hit him. But when he hit me back, everybody saw because we were on a sort of incline. And so this guy was almost, I mean, pulverized to death for beating up this fashion editor, which wasn't really his fault. So it does get pretty, pretty terrifying, I can tell you. And another time I was in Italy and I said to the people I was with, we should leave this place immediately. I think there's, I feel there's something really bad. And we left and the tent collapsed. And, you know, a couple of people were really badly hurt. And so it does get very hairy. On the other hand, it can be beautifully organized, as Sail on 7th was this week. We had a wonderful time. The tents were beautifully organized. Even we had that terrible rainstorm in the middle of the week, and they had snow to put the tents up. Then they had a heat wave. Then they had the monsoon. And, you know, it can be a wonderful experience. I love going because I love sitting there and watching the clothes. That's my real joy. And it's taken me a long, long time to get to the front row, but I'm now in the front row. So I'm a lot safer than anybody else is.
How much does it cost for you at Bazaar to cover a show, say, in Paris?
Well, we cover the shows. We start in London, then we go to Milan, then we go to Paris. And it costs me well over $100,000 to send my crew there. And that what annoys me is that the length of time we're there is almost a waste of time because we have long gaps between the designers we really want to see. And I feel that the authorities in each country actually should be pulling the time down because eventually it's going to be too expensive for us to go at all. And that'll be a very sad moment because it's where we get our adrenaline fixed for the next 6 months. So right now we're finishing June, but come July, the issue of July and August and September and October, we'll be using what we've just seen internationally for those issues.
Who wears the clothes? I understand that the clothes that you see in the fashion shows aren't for everyday wear. What is their point then?
Well, a lot of them are for everyday wear. The problem with the fashion shows is that there are now so many television cameras there that by the time that the television edits and airs 24 hours after the show, you eventually only see the really outlandish stuff. You know, if there's anything that the editors can, you know, the kind of the nudity that occurs on the show sometimes and the see-throughness obviously gets onto national television screens long before the good old camel coat gets there. So when we actually show pictures of the camel coat in August and September, ones that you and I'd like to wear and the raincoat and, you know, the nice pair of shoes, people are already terrified by the season because they've seen what the television companies have given them, with a few exceptions. But I go to the shows to look for the latest trends, yes, and those are what we publish in probably August and September. But we also give wide, wide range to, you know, the much more wearable sweaters and the skirts that just come to the knee and the very nice wrap-over coat. So there's a lot of clothes in all the magazines that you can actually wear if you really study it. Some of them are expensive, some of them are not. We try and balance the budget a bit for everybody.
You've been at this for, what, over 25 years, right?
Yeah.
You've seen every flip-flop then on fashion over that time. What keeps you interested in it?
I love clothes. I love fashion. I love the business. I have to say it's the most amazing business. It's full of incredible characters, really, really professional people, and an enormous amount of kindness, an enormous amount of love and friendship. And, you know, now the designers that I grew up with, you know, are like Karl Lagerfeld and Calvin and, you know, they're friends. And so for me, it's the only home I know, and I love it. It's really a wonderful life.
I want to thank you very much for talking today, Liz Tilberis. It was enjoyable.
Thank you, Barbara.
Liz Tilberis' new memoir is No Time to Die. Coming up, the music of Charles Ives. This is Fresh Air. Here's a story about how our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz finally found a recording he'd been trying to locate for more than 30 years.
Sometimes there are only 5 degrees of separation. About 30 years ago, I heard a concert at Harvard Sanders Theater I'll never forget. A song cycle by Hindemith sung by a wonderful American soprano named Helen Boatwright. The singing was limpid, honest, emotionally open. Her diction was perfect. Her voice was exquisite. I immediately wanted to get everything she'd ever recorded. And the recording I wanted most was an album of songs by the cantankerous American composer Charles Ives, with Boatwright accompanied by the great Ives pianist, Ives editor, and Ives scholar, John Kirkpatrick. That recording, on the small Overtone label, was already long out of print, and I was never able to find it. Let's skip a few years. At Sanders Theater a few weeks ago, there was a memorial tribute for the late violinist Louis Krasner and his wife, Adrienne Gallimere Krasner. Krasner had been a champion of modern music, and he made music history in 1936 by commissioning and playing the first performance of one of the masterpieces of 20th century music, Alban Berg's Violin Concerto. One of the speakers at Harvard was the 80-year-old composer and violinist Howard Boatwright, a student of Hindemith's at Yale, the editor of Charles Ives's papers, and the retired dean of the School of Music at Syracuse University, where Louis Krasner had taught before he retired in 1974. Sitting next to Howard Boatwright was his wife, Helen, looking as radiant as she did when I first heard her in the same auditorium some 30 years before. I wanted to meet her and introduced myself. I mentioned my futile search for that Ives record, and she told me that it had been reissued on CD by CRI, Composers Recording, Inc. That night, I headed to the nearest record store and found the disc. I wasn't disappointed. A song has a few rights, the same as other ordinary citizens, Ives wrote. If it feels like walking along the left-hand side of a street or sitting on a curb, why not let it? There's nothing predictable about an Ives song. Here's Helen Boatwright singing a passage from Ives's amazing 1914 setting of Vachel Lindsay's poem, General William Booth Enters into Heaven. Or try the quirky little Ann Street, a poem by someone named Morris Morris, that Ives found in the New York Herald on January 12, 1921. This CRICD also includes Helen Boatwright singing a series of Emily Dickinson poems set to music by her husband's colleague at Syracuse, Ernst Bacon, with the composer himself at the piano. Bacon worked on these from the 1930s to the 1960s, but they're not nearly as daring as what Ives wrote decades earlier. And this month, CRI has just released a CD devoted to the music of Howard Boatwright. 4 degrees of separation?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the songs of Charles Ives and Ernst Bacon, sung by Helen Boatwright on the CRI label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Chris Fraley, Al Banks, Audrey Bentham, and Fred Snyder. Today is the great Al Green's 52nd birthday. We'll close with one of our favorite recordings of his. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
I'm so in love with you. Whatever you want to do is all right. Spend my life with you. Me say scenes, baby, since we've been together. Ooh, loving you forever is what I need. Let me be the one you come. Never be untrue. Oh, baby, let's stay together. Loving you weather. Times are good or bad, happy or sad.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.